And Fridays are to you what they are to me, so let's move them along. All right, so this is where we left off. Previously, we talked about a little bit about methotrexate, and I actually think that this is a really good place to start off and kind of delineate. Even though methotrexate still falls under the category of S-phase antimetabolites, this is dealing with a folic acid metabolism. So again, just a reminder, here's folic acid. Methotrexate blocks the conversion into the active form which our body uses. The distinction now is that the rest of the antimetabolites are actually just modifications of our base pairs, the cytosine, guanine, thymine, and adenine. And what they did is, I kind of like to think of them as kind of like doppelgangers. They're good enough to get into the party and on the list, but once they're there, they're non-functional. What you do is you modify these chains or side chains and replace molecules with other molecules. So it fits into the spot, but it's not the exact same thing. And so basically, when it comes down to the use of DNA for either transcription and translation, these false base pairs basically prevent anything from happening. They're non-functional. So, interestingly enough, they can be combined with each other. Now, typically, when we talk about regimens, we typically talk about not using overlapping mechanisms of action, just because it gives you more of a synergistic effect rather than a duplication. So, as it turns out, these can be used together, and you'll see them in more ancient regimens and things like in leukemias where you need a little bit more help. So you have both purines and pyrimidines. So the first one is we're going to talk about is 5-fluorouracil, which is our pyrimidine analog. And interesting thing about this one, and one of the nice reasons why we can talk about it, is actually the mechanism of action of this drug, even though it is a false base pair it falsely integrates, it actually has two different mechanisms of action. So the false base integration into RNA and DNA is done via a bolus administration. So if you remember what we were talking about the other day on Tuesday about how a bolus is a single quick push of a medication, the mechanism of action is what you would think it would be. Now, if you give it continuously, so that means you hook them up to an IV bag and you give it to them over hours and hours and hours, the mechanism of action actually is seen in this slide. This is 5-fluorouracil. So it actually inhibits thymidylate synthetase, which then decreases those stores. Interestingly enough, we can combine that with leucovorin, which we talked about the other day with methotrexate. Instead of being a rescue medication with 5-fluorouracil, it actually stabilizes the complex and enhances the mechanism. Interestingly enough, genomics plays a role in 5-fluorouracil, and it messes with the clearance of the drug. So mechanistically speaking, basically without going into a lot of detail for the sake of time, there are two different mechanisms. You can see that 5-fluorouracil can go to affect RNA and also the DNA. In practice, as it turns out, you can use both mechanisms to your advantage. When you look at a regimen like FOLFOX, which was actually developed at Roswell, you can see here you have oxaliplatin, which we talked about earlier the other day. This is our non-cell cycle specific agent. It is a platinum analog. Then we have 5-FU given as a bolus and then as a continuous infusion. So you get both mechanisms. Interestingly enough, to kind of highlight the importance of the difference and the distinction of these two, is that the side effects of 5-fluorouracil are dependent on the administration technique. So that means you get more myelosuppression with the bolus, and you can also have chest pain. With the continuous infusion, you see more of the GI side effects. So, in a patient that is having some myelosuppressive action, so let's say their platelet count is a little too low, if you hold the bolus, you actually get rid of the myelosuppression. So in patients that are having some platelet toxicities or other types, we can hold a bolus, still give the rest of the regimen, and still get the effects that we have or we desire. Next drug is cytarabine. We talked about cytarabine a little bit when we were talking about the fractional kill hypothesis. Cytarabine is also a prodrug. Needs to be converted in the body to its active component. Interestingly enough, the side effects are dose-dependent at this one as well. Myelosuppression and rash can occur at any dose, but when you get into the higher doses, you have conjunctivitis and Celebellar syndrome. The Celebellar syndrome, just as an aside, we actually have to test for it before each dose being administered, so every patient next door. They actually do what looks like a sobriety test to make sure that they can tolerate the drug. Mercaptopurine, or 6-MP, is our purine analog example that we'll talk about. This one is also developed by Sydney Farber. And this one inhibits purine synthesis and acts as a false base pair in DNA. Interestingly enough, we'll talk about the myelosuppression a little bit when we look at the metabolic pathway. Again, I'm not going to focus a lot on this, other than the fact that TPMT is polymorphic. And TPMT is seen in several different stages of it. Where's the other one? Lost. In any case, you can see that the 6-mercaptopurine goes through a multi-step enzymatic process in which it's inactivated. When you have these polymorphisms that shunt off and inhibit the metabolism to an inactive metabolite, these patients will actually show up with more profound myelosuppression. So there is some pharmacogenetics that plays a role in this. And as a consequence of that, we don't necessarily test for these genomic differences. We basically wait for the phenotypic response, which is myelosuppression. Interestingly enough, those patients that do have the polymorphism for the loss of function of TPMT end up doing better. It's just a matter of whether they can tolerate the myelosuppression and the cytotoxicity. And that kind of talks about that. So moving on into natural products. And so these natural products, I always kind of laugh at this picture, because it makes you think about it, that these are all coming from naturally occurring sources. And we think about those people out in the world who just want to do things the natural way and how that it's healthier and safer and so on and so forth. And then you look at these drugs. So let's start out with topoisomerase. So there are two types of topoisomerases for those from your biochemistry days. There's one that topoisomerase 1, which causes a single-strand break in the 5' to 3' direction. And then there's type 2 topoisomerase, which causes a double-strand break. Now, there are drugs that specifically bind to one or the other and not both. And so it's kind of nice to know them because, again, when we talk about different uses in therapy, we talk about not using duplicate mechanisms of action. So the first one we'll talk about is doxorubicin. This actually comes from a Streptococcus species, and there are other members of the drug class here. This one as well is a prodrug and basically inhibits topoisomerase 2, preventing the religation of DNA. It also has other mechanisms of action that contribute to its use, including DNA intercalation and then prevention of free radical formation. One of the things that is I should point out is that this includes the word ruby in it, and this drug is colored red. So if any of you have worked in it in the lab or seen any red-colored chemo, it is something based off of doxorubicin. One of the reason why I like to point that out is that it's nice to remember that the main side effect from this drug is cardiotoxicity. So you think about blood being red and it goes through the heart and cardiotoxicity. This can be enhanced with either cyclophosphamide or radiation, and there are actually lifetime dosing limits. So I'll give you an example of what lifetime dosing means. Doxorubicin is used very commonly in lymphoma regimens and breast cancer regimens. Both cancers typically can happen in your age group and my age group. And as a consequence of that, we have to kind of keep track of that. One of the things that happens with all chemotherapy, especially this stuff, is that you can actually induce cancer by using these agents. So P53 people exposed to many of the agents that we talked about are at an increased risk of developing cancer and secondary cancers years and years and years later. It's important is that we use doxorubicin and anthracyclines in these curable cancers that are early on in age, and then they also play a role in secondary leukemias. So these lifetime dosing limits actually do matter. In addition to that, you have the typical side effects that you expect, the myelosuppression, the alopecia, and nausea and vomiting. Interestingly enough, although it seems scary, it is rather benign. There is a red discoloration while the drug is being cleared in the urine, tears, and also CNS fluid if we take spinal taps. Yes? Etoposide. So etoposide comes from the mandrake plant. This causes an accumulation of the S phase and leading to apoptosis. This one is the one that really is tied to secondary malignancy. There's really a lot of data to support this one. Outside of that, it just causes a little myelosuppression and alopecia. Irinotecan is our example of a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor. I like to remember that this one inhibits topoisomerase 1 because it starts with an I, and it's Roman numeral for 1. This is as well as a prodrug. It's converted into the body into the active metabolite SN38. SN38 is the one that has the action on topoisomerase 1. SN38 is inactivated by an enzyme called UGT1A1. UGT1A1 is polymorphic as well. The important thing to remember about this is that this causes a lot of diarrhea. And in particular, those patients that have a UGT1A1 polymorphism will have a tremendous amount of diarrhea. And so the saying is, I run to the can. That's how you remember the diarrhea with the irinotecan. The diarrhea can be very, very profound, and patients will report on average of 6 to 7 bowel movements a day. If you look at the AUCs in these patients, so this is irinotecan or the parent drug or prodrug, and this is the active metabolite. You see the different genotypes there. 1/1 is the wild type, and then you see the mutant type. Based on the metabolism pathway, there's no difference in irinotecan AUCs across the different genotypes. When we talk, and so that means that this metabolism is insaturable. So when we get to the SN38, you can see that there is a distinction between the different genotypes. The polymorphism, 10% of the patient population is homozygous for the STAR28 allele, and the association of diarrhea and the decreased function allele is tied. Even those patients that are heterozygous will have some form of diarrhea that is worsened. So we don't necessarily test against it, but we do see it in patients. In these patients, we sometimes have to result in dose reductions, dose delays, a lot of modifications to supportive care. Moving on into antimitotic agents, these two are natural products, even though mechanistically they're different from the topoisomerase inhibitors. So we know that microtubules are made up of alpha and beta tubulin, and they grow from the spinal pole towards the metaphase plate. So they start here and they grow out. And the alpha and the beta combine, and they have these repetition until they grow, and then they get broken apart. There are drugs that affect both the assembly and disassembly of the microtubules. The vincas prevent the assembly and therefore the growing, and then the taxanes prevent the microtubule disassembly. So taxanes, we call them polymerizing agents because they inhibit the depolymerization. They are obtained from the Pacific yew tree, and our example of that is paclitaxel. Paclitaxel is the Pacific yew tree. The other ones are synthetic components of taxanes and modifications of the original structure. These drugs are extremely hydrophobic in nature, and they actually contain in castor oil. So if you ever work with these, you'll notice that it's obviously in an oil-based solution, and therefore it's very thick and difficult to work with. It's important, and I point that out because castor oils are one of the reasons for the side effects. A lot of patients can have allergic reactions or allergic-like reactions to the administration of the chemo. In addition to that, the taxane cause a whole litany of different side effects. I think they don't necessarily known for one particular side effect. They're known to cause a whole bunch of different side effects. So they can include things like myelosuppression, alopecia, neuropathy, myalgias, so on and so forth. You can use, in some cases, there is some cross-sensitivity between paclitaxel and docetaxel and albumin-bound paclitaxel. And in some cases, like the cis and carboplatin, you can play with the side effects to get the desired side effect profile that you're looking for. On the other hand, you have vinca alkaloids that come from periwinkle plants. They look like that. Basically, they prevent the growth or the polymerization of the microtubules. There are three members of that class, vincristine, vinblastine, and vinorelbine. The main side effect to these are their neurotoxicity, and the saying is no vines in the spine. The neurotoxicity can present in different forms. It can either be a peripheral neuropathy, like the tingling sensation we all have when our arms fall asleep, or it could be like a loss of function where you're not able to write your name clearly or use buttons or zippers or anything like that. That fine motor coordination tends to go. So this is kind of a list of very generic and very broad indications and usage of them. It's not all inclusive, but it's meant to give you an idea that these do have extensive uses and also can be fairly specific to the different types of cancer. So again, like spectrum of activity, similar to what you see with antibiotics and antivirals. So in a nutshell, these are our traditional chemotherapy agents. We use them in a variety of different cancers. Members of the same drug class can have different side effect profile. We use combinations of different mechanisms of action, administer in different ways and in different patients. And sometimes side effects can be dose-dependent and administration-dependent. So chemotherapy regimens, in a very generic nutshell, agents have to be active against a different cancer. However, we select agents with different mechanisms of action, resistance, and dose-limiting toxicities, or toxicities in general. And so combinations need to maximize kills and limit resistance. And so in a lot of sense, you're balancing a lot of toxicity and efficacy. So if we look at a regimen like CHOP, which is used in lymphomas, we have four drugs here listed here. Cyclophosphamide, this is our nonspecific one. This alkylates into the DNA. The side effects we talked about, myelosuppression, nausea, vomiting, kidney dysfunction, alopecia. The doxorubicin, which is our topoisomerase inhibitor, which is S-phase, causes cardiotoxicity. There is some overlapping nausea and vomiting, and so the emesis risk of this regimen is considered high. There is some overlapping of the myelosuppression as well. Vincristine is the benefit of having just neuropathy, no other contributory myelosuppression or nausea and vomiting, but this targets our M phase. Prednisone, which is used a lot in the heme malignancies, actually is immunosuppressive and immunotoxic at high enough doses. And those side effects are different, even though we didn't cover it. And so you can kind of see how it's kind of like a orchestra of different mechanisms and different toxicities and side effects. So one of the things to know is that, and when you think about this in a really generic and a basic understanding, is that these traditional agents are indiscriminate killers of cells. So if you think about it, it's kind of like carpet bombing that was used in World War II. You would just level a city in hopes of hitting the bad guys. As we're talking about these more, as we go into these more targeted approaches, now it's very, very selective or more selective and less off-target toxicity, so it's a more tactical type bombing. traditional chemotherapy assumes that all fast-growing cells are cancerous and all slow-growing cells are not. And we talked about how the heterogeneous nature of the tumor says that that's not really the case, and that's really important. So then, along the way, we've had a couple moments of serendipity, and we've had a couple of discoveries. In the 1980s, there were two big developments. The first one is all-trans-retinoic acid, or ATRA, that's used in APL, which is a subtype of acute leukemia. As it turns out, this is very specific to the immature cells that are causing the APL, and causes these cells to differentiate and then undergo apoptosis as a consequence of their flawed genetics. This, along with another drug, arsenic trioxide, has actually led to chemo-free regimens in APL. In addition, more widely known, tamoxifen was developed in the 1980s, and this is used in hormone-positive breast cancer. So tamoxifen targets ERPR receptors, or estrogen receptors, or progesterone receptors, in those cancers that are overexpressed. It basically starves the cancer cells of the driver, the estrogen and the progesterone, and therefore can control cancer growth. So therapy has obviously moved to these more targeted approach. Now we have immunotherapy that's also on the way. So targeted therapy, and more specifically molecularly targeted therapies, are specific to the genes, proteins, and the tissue environments. One of the things that's unique about these agents is that there is a very, very narrow therapeutic use for them. And as you kind of talk about them in therapy, you realize that you're looking for specific genes and mutations and subtypes, which really, really narrows their use and prevents them from being used very widely. So we need to be genotyping these patients, and they have to have the mutations that target it. So what makes a good target? This seems pretty obvious, but it's good to review it in the sense that if you're trying to think about ways and things to target in cancer and therapeutics, basically things that are only present in or on cancer cells, this is ideal. More commonly found on or in cancer cells, that's a little less ideal, but still pretty good. Or target on both cancer and normal cells, but the normal cells regenerate, which is the least ideal of the three. So more specifically, we'll talk about small molecule inhibition from here on out. We're going to skip over the monoclonal antibodies that act extracellularly and talk more or less on the intracellular brethren. So tyrosine kinase inhibitors is kind of where we're going with this. And so tyrosine kinase, as a review again, phosphorylates ATP, tyrosine, serine, and threonine. And that causes or interferes with survival and proliferation. These class of drugs are usually competitive inhibitors of the ATP binding domain. So they are not necessarily an allosteric binding site. These are the ones that are actually going to the ATP binding site. They may also target not only just the transmembrane proteins, but also the intracellular downstream enzymes as well. So these are four key issues or pearls to remember with most of the tyrosine kinase inhibitors. This is more or less for, from a pharmacy standpoint, I guess, if you will. But they all tend to have some interaction with CYP3A4, as well as commonality between CYP3A4 and PGP. There's generally a connection between the two of them. And so you're always looking for how it interacts with CYP3A4 and PGP. Food and administration with regards to having a full stomach or fatty foods to increase the intestinal absorption and or acid production. So absorption is one of those things that can limit how the drug gets into the body. There are various components to the absorption process. The first thing is getting it into solution so that it can cross over from the gut into circulation. Then you have to worry about it surviving the hepatic first pass metabolism, which can limit the amount of active metabolite that goes on to the rest of the body. In addition to that, the acidity is important, which can cause change the absorption. And we'll talk about an example of that. And also the last one is compliance, which is patients need to take their medication. And this seems very simple and overstated, but it really isn't, and I have data to show that. I think the best way to explain these TKIs is really to look at CML, because CML is really the poster child for how TKIs work. And so basically, when I like the picture of the magic bullet, this is what it is. Gleevec, which is the original compound, imatinib, was on the cover of Time back in, I think, 2000, 2001, in that area. I remember actually reading this. So CML, or the majority of CML, about 90 plus percent of CML, has this translocation of 922, which is infamously the Philadelphia chromosome. And basically it puts BCR, the breakpoint cluster region, close to the Abelson-Murine leukemia gene, which causes a lot of proliferation. And BCR-ABL is the tyrosine kinase that is cytokine-independent on signal for these leukemic cells to grow. So, and they'll proliferate uncontrollably. So CML, in a very basic sense, goes through phases. This refers to the genetic instability, and that kind of goes along with this oncogenic addition to BCR-ABL. So in the early chronic phase of the disease, the disease is primarily controlled based on BCR-ABL, meaning that the genetic messiness that is cancer is very, very low in the early phases of the disease, and in fact is reliant only on BCR-ABL in this early phase. As it reaches an anaplastic threshold, there become an accumulation of other mutational abnormalities. But in this early phase, it's almost entirely BCR-ABL. Now, this is what makes CML unique. We know that a lot of cancers have a whole variety of mutations, not just BCR-ABL or just one single mutation. There's usually many, many different ones, but this is one of the only ones that has just one. This phase can last anywhere from 3 to 5 years, and most patients are asymptomatic. The reason why they're asymptomatic, even though they may have high white counts and a lot of reason to have symptoms, is because this is a very, very gradual incline. As the disease progresses, the body is not able to acclimate to the changing dynamics of the cancer, and in these accelerated and blast crises is where you can start to have some of these symptomatic components of that. And so you can have things like fatigue, night sweats, and fever, which wouldn't be present necessarily in the early chronic phase. And then there's this blast crisis where basically it transforms into an acute leukemia. So imatinib came on the market in 2001, and this revolutionized CML treatment. Prior to this, they were using therapies like interferon and chemotherapy, which ultimately was a death sentence. It kind of just prolonged things a little bit here. With the advent of Gleevec and the related compounds, patients are now, 15, 20 years out from their original diagnosis. So really, really incredible change in disease progression. So basically, it inhibits the active conformation of BCR-ABL enzyme. In addition to it, now I said that this was a magic bullet to some extent, but there are other off-target tyrosine kinases like SARC, c-KIT, and PDGFR. So it has multi-kinase activity, and that's important to know. These off-target effects are what cause these side effects. And not that I want you to memorize the side effects of imatinib, but you can see, just pay attention to them, because they will change as we talk about the other agents. Unfortunately, there are resistant mechanisms to these, and basically the BCR-ABL binding domains change, which inactivates it to imatinib. In addition, you can over-amplify the signal, requiring more imatinib to be required to control the disease. And as I said before, it competes for the ATP binding domain, binding in there. Importantly enough, as I mentioned, modifications to this pocket will change the activity of imatinib and, you know, basically cause resistance to the drug. Okay, so now we have really, really good control of the disease. These drugs work very, very well up front. This drug works very, very well up front. And control a whole huge percentage of patients put on imatinib. There are class side effects to the TKIs and CML, and they can include our cytopenias and rash, and some modification and dosing strategies to managing that. Unfortunately, there were patients that did relapse in the original imatinib trials, which, of course, drug competition, they wanted to see what other compounds are out there. So dasatinib came out a little bit time after that. This is considered a second-generation BCR-ABL inhibitor, being that it could bind to both the active and the inactive conformations of the molecule. In addition, this one is 325 times more potent than imatinib, which makes you think that this makes this a better drug, right? As it turns out, that has not translated into a difference in overall survival, which is a really gold standard in therapeutics. So as a consequence of this, it doesn't necessarily replace imatinib as a frontline agent. It's just another frontline agent, if that makes sense. In addition, it was shown to have activity in all those patients that were resistant to imatinib, except for this rare occasion where it's T315I mutation that is very, very resistant to a lot of TKIs. Like imatinib, it's a once-a-day medication. I like to point that out because compliance is important. So its pearls in placement therapy is that it can be used in first line or after progression of imatinib. What's important is that this one doesn't. This one does rely on acid. In order for it to be effective. So medications that cause, or antacid medications like proton pump inhibitors or H2 blockers, so these are the Prilosecs of the world, the Pepcids of the world, really have to be very, very careful about using these medications in combination with the dasatinib. It lowers the efficacy of the dasatinib. In addition, the myalgias and rashes don't occur with this medication. Instead, you replace it with pulmonary side effects like pulmonary hypertension and then pulmonary edemas. So you can see the side effect profile is vastly different, even though they do the same thing in a very, very basic sense, which gives you an idea that if you start playing with the characteristics of the drug, the structure of the drug, you can change the spectrum of activity just a little bit so that it provides an added value, even though on the surface it looks like a me-too drug. So, not to be outdone, Novartis came out with their own second generation called the nilotinib. Now, nilotinib is also more potent than imatinib. It will bind the closed conformation. It has a higher affinity than imatinib. It also has off-target effects. One of the things about imatinib that's important to point out is that compliance and adherence is important, and this one is taken twice a day. So that becomes a really big issue when patients are not really all that compliant. Now, that might not seem like a big thing, but most patients, about 80% of patients, will be compliant with a once-a-day medication. That drops to 50% when you add it to twice a day. So that means half of the patients that go on a medication, any medication, not just a cancer medication, their compliance will drop to about 50%. One of the things that's really important about that I should mention is if you have symptomatic CML and you take nilotinib or twice-a-day medication, you get that under control, your symptoms go away. What happens is with patients on very, very long-term medications, when their symptoms go away or they don't feel it, that's when the compliance issue becomes a bigger issue because they don't necessarily feel a difference between taking it once a day or twice a day. This one, in addition, hasn't been shown to be superior to imatinib, and therefore it can be used at first line or at progression because it's been shown to be effective in imatinib-resistant cancers. This one also tends to affect the heart a little bit more. And so QTC prolongation or arrhythmias can occur with the use of nilotinib in patients that are higher risk of those things. There is some hepatic toxicity as well. So again, you see a whole wide variety of different toxicities. So how do you pick between them? The potency difference haven't translated into any therapeutic advantage overall. Overall survival hasn't been changed, and now that these drugs are literally 10, 15 years out, you still don't see a difference in overall survival. And that's pretty impressive, and that also is impressive to note that these drugs are that effective. The one difference that you will see in them is that the time to response is much, much faster with the second generation. So nilotinib and dasatinib will get you a complete response or a response much faster than imatinib. So if the toxicities are or the symptoms of the disease are particularly debilitating or requiring a more prompt intervention, that would make you favor using dasatinib or nilotinib. The other thing that I didn't mention about the dasatinib is that it does tend to have a lot of activity in CNS disease. So if any patients have CNS lesions, you will see a preference for that one as well. But outside of those very strict and narrow uses, there is no difference between picking one over the other. So you basically decide on its ability, the toxicities, and the ability to tolerate the toxicities, the comorbid conditions. So remember, patients with a baseline cardiac issue probably shouldn't be starting on nilotinib. And those patients that have some baseline pulmonary disease doesn't necessarily mean that you should start on dasatinib. And so it makes it kind of all three are a good choice. You just base it on the patient, which, you know, is not as important for you guys as it is to realize that, you know, if you have drugs that are very similar, if you find niches that work for these very similar compounds, you can make a drug marketable. And then there's an additional one. So the next drug we'll talk about is bosutinib. So bosutinib, and the reason why it's not listed here on the frontline therapy and on the progression is that it went against imatinib, and the makers of bosutinib put it up head-to-head in the superiority trial up front. So in frontline, up front, they went for superiority, and they missed their mark. So even though it's 200 times more potent, has activity in nilotinib, imatinib, and dasatinib-resistant cancers, it's still second line. And the reason for that is because they lost in superiority. This one is once a day as well. PPIs decrease concentrations of this. And the toxicity is diarrhea and hepatic. Which highlights the idea that you need to be careful about how you design your trials as well. Third line therapy. You can use a second or third TKI, depending on things. Now, interestingly enough, we talked about dasatinib and nilotinib being active in imatinib-resistant cancers. Imatinib has not been shown to be active in their resistant cancers, so meaning imatinib is only used frontline, and then the other second generations can be used second line. It's just a small distinction that can be made. So after you failed two or three TKIs, you open up the possibility of using an allogeneic stem cell transplant or omecitaxine. So omecitaxine binds to ribosomes, does not bind to BCR-ABL. This one is twice daily sub-Q, so it's given under the skin twice a day. So that limits compliance because who's going to give themselves shots twice a day? And then there's this last example of T315I mutation. Now this is a very, very resistant type of CML. It's very, very rare to find this in a frontline, in a newly diagnosed patient. This is usually something that's brought on. In this situation, clinical trial, omecitaxine, although omecitaxine, remember, is not a TKI, the only TKI that's active in this situation is ponatinib. And ponatinib is another second-generation TKI. And the reason why we don't use ponatinib and we haven't talked about it up until this point is that the side effects are pretty brutal. So this one has a lot of kinases that it'll bind to, tyrosine kinases, VEGFR, PDGFR, SARC-KIT, RED-TIE, FLT3, so on and so forth. All of these contribute to the fact that they cause life-threatening blood clot and narrowing of blood vessels. So I'm a pharmacist. I know that this is pretty bad. You don't need to be a physician to say that this is pretty bad. And it's only available through a very restricted access program. But it is sensitive to these mutations. So if you have a patient that develops these, you would use ponatinib. This one is once a day, and you have to avoid PPIs with this one as well. So let's talk about the resistance, because I've kind of glazed over it to this point in time. Primary resistance to imatinib and the others is very, very rare. And 75% of patients will have a complete cytogenetic response to imatinib up front. So imatinib is successful in 75% of patients up front. Secondary resistance is more common. Now, we know as a group that resistance is something that comes upon. We know that it can be random. However, there is something that's really important. We have to ID them and realize that if we have this one in particular, that's really a really big problem because there's only one TKI that can be used for that. So we use, we do analyses on these patients that end up being, that don't obtain a molecular response within 3 months or cytogenetic response within 6 to 12 months. And we look and see what's going on. We consider this mutational analysis for those that don't have an inadequate initial response and those that have a loss of response or progression. Now, compliance, and I guess a little selling point for myself and my peers and colleagues. So education and adherence and monitoring is important. In this trial, they looked at non-adherence with imatinib and looked at the responses with them. Adherence less than 85% had a higher probability of losing that cytogenetic response at 2 years. This is statistically significant, even though I didn't mark it that way. This is also the only independent predictor for achieving a complete molecular response. So compliance is really, really, really important. And in the case of CML, basically it's the deciding factor of whether or not the drug is going to work. And this is the data just to highlight that and show that. Adherence rates greater than are the dotted lines, less than are those solid lines. And you can see that the probability of imatinib failure is quite high when you're non-adherent, and responses are also tied to that. So it is important to realize how your drug is being administered as you develop things that, you know, if you're requiring multiple times a day, you have to look at the kinetics, you have to look at the dynamics, you have to realize that patients have to sit through this stuff and have to take this stuff in order for it to work. So those accelerated phases, as it turns out, going back to the therapeutics, we talked about chronic phase and all that stuff that we talked about earlier is really referring to the chronic phase. In accelerated phase, you can actually use the same TKIs. We use them at higher doses because of the volume and the burden of disease. So you can actually increase the dose to actually increase the efficacy of the drug, and that kind of makes sense, but we have to highlight that. Now, this comes at a higher risk of toxicity and side effects. These patients at these higher doses are more likely to have toxicity. So we're not going to start people at these high doses just because we want to. So these dose escalation is reserved for those patients that are having progression. Blast crisis, they do have a role for blast crisis as well. Even though we consider this a transformation into an acute leukemia, those patients would undergo basically a induction chemotherapy, so the aggressive chemotherapy. We would add a TKI to help improve the responses because of the presence of BCR in ABL. So, in short, there is a value in Me Too drugs as long as you figure out the way to get there. You have to realize that there are some modifications that you can make. There are basically 5 CML TKI agents, and I've kind of presented roles for each of them in therapy to show that there is some differences, especially in cancer. And both the similarity and differences matter. Good science behind the drugs has shown that you can use them in different indications. They have different toxicity profile because of their off-target effects, efficacy and treatment failure situations. And does the similarity mean that they're equivalent or interchangeable? And I've shown that in a couple examples, not only with the TKIs, but also the conventional stuff as well. We can change the dose for different scenarios, and there are other drugs outside of cancer that use similar ideas and concepts. And also compliance is very important. So, final remarks and kind of getting out of the therapeutics of things. User toxicity and survivorship. So I kind of highlighted this before when we were talking about etoposide and doxorubicin. These drugs are tied to secondary cancers, and you need to consider that. These studies show that these agents increase the risk of cancer in healthcare workers as well. Now, any of you guys that are going to be working in drug development or in labs in particular need to be careful and mindful of this, because these drugs in small amounts have been shown to have higher rates of cancer in these healthcare workers and higher rates of infertility issues and birth defects as well. So these aren't benign things, and it's really, really important. So you should be wearing and being very adherent, and this includes men too, not just women. You should be very, very mindful of how to handle these agents in hoods and wearing the protective gloves, wearing the right types of gloves. These things are stuff that you shouldn't take for granted. Refer to OSHA and NIOSH standards. Don't rely on the people working above you to pick the best equipment for that. You should check this out yourself, especially if you don't want to, especially if you're exposed over prolonged time, and especially if you'd like to have children. That's kind of something that's important. So protect yourself and learn the rules. So there's one last toxicity that I do want to talk about. And that is financial toxicity. Now, financial toxicity is a really, really big thing going on right now, and the decision of discerning the value of a drug in therapy. Now, with CML, I talked about several different TKIs that all do the same thing and have very, very similar spectrum of action. But it's important to note that there's a fine line between finding that value and kind of stretching the truth, if you will. And there have been some major cancer centers that have voted against using certain drugs that don't really appear to have any therapeutic advantage at all. And Sloan Kettering is a really good example of that. They, a couple years ago, were very famous in blocking a drug on formulary called Zaltrap. In addition to that, financial toxicity is, there's a new grading scale for this, financial harm caused by accepting costly therapies. These drugs can cost many, many thousand dollars a month, and even after a 80% coverage from insurance, you know, if a drug costs $10,000 a month and they cover 80% of that, that's $2,000 a month out of pocket. There are not a lot of people that can afford $2,000 a month out of pocket. So some consideration needs to go into the benefit given. And there is, there are some development of guidelines to decide which therapies are cost effective out there and which ones are worth their cost. So we know about imatinib. We talked about it. When it first came out in 2001, it was $5,000 a month. Now it's actually more than this. It's closer, I think, to $12,000 a month for the same drug and dosage form. Novartis did not change imatinib in any way, shape, or form. So why are they charging that much? And that is, it, you know, you don't have to be an economist to know that, that it does not reflect inflation. In addition to that, immunotherapies cost $100,000 a year. Roswell is in the process. Yeah. Roswell, recently we're going to be starting people on CAR T-cell, and those started about 500,000. And you can see that basically this is unsustainable. And how are you going to decide which therapies and which patients should get a $500,000 therapy next door? That's a big question. The nausea medications are in about $1,000 a cycle. And supportive care is probably in the range of $10,000 or about $8,000 a cycle. So that's pretty impressive just from that perspective. So these costs are not sustainable for patients. So one thing to ponder is this grading scale for toxicity and financial. And even at grade one, you can see use of charity grants and fundraising. Co-payment program is already grade one. Lifestyle modification, so deferring large purchases. You're not going to go on that trip to Europe and or Hawaii because of this expenditure. That's considered grade one. Grade four, on the other hand, you know, consideration of suicide, selling home, bankruptcy. It doesn't take long to get here, and it doesn't take most patients will run out of their savings within a couple months. Yeah. So if you are able to figure this stuff out, you'll be very successful and people will love you. So think about that as well. If you're able to optimize your drugs, and I can talk about data and ideas that probably people, the drug companies, are ripping us off. There are those examples out there. So with that, I'll take any questions, and otherwise, I got you 7 minutes closer to your weekend. Yeah. It's crazy. And